Good morning, welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm your host, Hugh LaFollette. On the show this week, I'll be talking to Randall Ray, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and our topic will be the origins of money. Randall, glad to have you on the show.
Thank you.
All right, let's begin by talking a little bit about what the standard view of the origins of money are. I mean, maybe to give the listener a sense of what we're going to be doing, there's a certain standard story about how money arose, what it means, and you're in the end going to disagree with that, but it's important to begin by talking about what the standard view is. So perhaps you could give a succinct summary of what that standard view is.
Okay. I think probably most of your listeners are familiar with the typical view, perhaps from their introductory economics course, in which it's supposed that there, way back in the beginning, there were markets that were based on barter, sort of free markets with higgling and haggling, and people bartered, say, bananas for coconuts. This is usually derived from some hypothesis that people have a natural propensity to truck and barter. Adam Smith had a statement something like this. The problem is that barter requires a double coincidence of wants. In other words, you've got bananas and I've got fish, and we can only trade if you want my fish and I want your bananas. So that is where we begin. Somewhere along the line, on some particular day, this trade couldn't take place because we didn't have a double coincidence of wants. In other words, I had something that you did not want, so you wouldn't trade. So we came up with the idea of using something to lubricate the market mechanism, which is the way economists put it, and just simply a medium of exchange. For example, we might settle on the use of colorful seashells so that I could, for example, buy your bananas by giving you seashells on the days that you don't want my fish. So that's really the standard view, and traditional economics builds up its view of money based on this very simple parable. Not that economists believe that it necessarily happened this way, but they think it's a useful way to get at what the nature of money is all about.
Okay. The appeal of that seems to me to be pretty clear why someone might think that that was the right kind of parable. So let's talk a little bit about what the implications of that view are. You say that economists talk about this as the appropriate parable for thinking about money. Presumably there are some implications for this for our understanding of money today, our understanding of the economy, and in particular the understanding of the role of government in our economy.
Yeah, this view is that the main thing about money is that it's used in exchange, that it facilitates markets. It makes it easier to engage in exchanges. But conventional economic theory argues that money really is not important. We could do all this stuff without the money. Maybe it's a little more inconvenient. But money has no real necessity. We could have markets based on barter. And this leads to the view that money is non-essential. And in fact, in most economic theory, all that money does is determines the rate of inflation. Now, you might say, well, who cares about economic theory? But it has a policy implication, and the main one is that for the last 20 years, the guiding theory of the Federal Reserve Bank, including Alan Greenspan, is monetarist, which is an extreme form of this view, which really does argue that money mainly just determines inflation, and if that's true, what you want to do is to try to control the growth of the money supply in order to prevent inflation from occurring. And if money really doesn't matter for anything else, then we really shouldn't worry much about monetary policy. So the conventional view is that monetary policy mainly just affects prices. It doesn't affect things that we might worry about, such as unemployment or what our real wage is. That is, how much can we actually buy with our wages? Those things supposedly are not much impacted by monetary policy.
All right, so the only thing that the Fed should be worrying about, the only thing that the government should be worrying about on this view when it sets monetary policy is to make sure that there's not too much money, which on that view would lead to inflation.
That's right, and
okay.
This was explicitly the policy of our Fed. Now, things have gotten a little bit more murky in the last 10 years, but I can tell you that the dominant paradigm that drives monetary policy formation around the world is that monetary policy controls the rate of inflation, and many countries actually have adopted into the laws that govern what their central banks do an inflation target that is supposed to be the only target the central bank pays any attention to.
Okay. I take it that what you want to say is that this view of the origins of money is misleading.
Yes.
That and the first point I take it you want to make is it's misleading historically. Maybe you can briefly say why.
Okay. The anthropologists actually have been telling us for 150 years that this story is just not historically accurate. We can't find examples of markets based on barter. All the markets we know about had money involved in the exchanges. We know that people in tribal society developed very complex systems of gift exchange, complex webs of mutual aid, hierarchies of domination, extensive networks of personal debts and credits, but none of these develop markets and money. So there really is something different about markets and money that we don't find in tribal society. Societies that use money and have markets are much different sorts of societies, not like Robinson Crusoe and Friday. So we just can't find examples historically or in tribal societies that existed, say, 150 years ago. Can't find examples of markets based on barter. So that part of the story seems to be historically inaccurate.
Okay, but I take it that the troubles you have with the view, I mean, again, part of it is that you think it's just not an historically accurate picture, but I take it you also think that there are other problems with the view, what you might call logical problems with the view. Could you explain those for the listener, please?
Yeah, when I gave our very simple example of you and I engaging in these trades and deciding to settle on the use of seashells, well, you can imagine a situation in which a couple of individuals could sit down and make that sort of a decision. But how can we settle on one particular thing to use the medium of exchange? If we multiply that by hundreds or thousands of traders, how could you possibly get the kind of consensus required? You know, if you had some sort of a dictator, the dictator could tell you what the medium of exchange is going to be, and we can see how that could come about. But the traditional story is supposed to be based on this primeval free market economy that just got going based on barter, and then somehow suddenly we all move to one particular medium of exchange. It's very hard to explain that logically, and no one actually has been able to do it. The other problem I have with the story is I think more significant than the historical problems or the logical problems, and that is that I think that it really gives us the wrong picture of the nature of money. Is money really neutral? That is, does it really not matter? It only determines the rate of inflation. I think economists might be willing to accept that. In fact, most economists do, and most economic models actually don't have money in the models. But I think to the average person out there, this is just absolutely ludicrous. Money obviously does matter. You know, try paying off your car loan with a crate of bananas, or you know, would you be willing to accept your weekly salary in the form of a truckload of steer manure? Obviously not. People want money. And if we removed money from our economy, it's very difficult to believe that that would have no significant impact. So that's the main problem I have with the traditional view of the origins of money, which sheds light on the nature of money.
Okay. Yeah, in fact, that's going to sort of lead us into this description of this alternate view. I take it you've got a different story, both of the history of how money came to be and, as you used the language earlier, a different parable, if you will, about how to understand its origins. Part of that I find most intriguing, I think it would be interesting to the listeners, that it is somehow tied up not in markets, the origins, not in markets, but in the penal system. Could you explain why?
Okay. Yeah, this is my little parable, and I think that this does accord with the historical facts as we know them. We know that in tribal society, that is, before there were markets, before there was money, that tribal peoples developed very complex compensation schedules and measurements. These common compensation schedules, such as the so-called Wehrgeld, were designed to prevent blood feuds whereby a transgressor would pay a fine to a victim. So in the case of an accidental murder, let's say, the murderer would have to pay to the victim's family a particular fine. These fines were established in public assemblies, and each tribal society had a very complex schedule that would fix the payment for every kind of crime that might be committed. And crimes here are very broadly defined. There was something called bride price, which I think gives you the wrong idea. It makes you think that they bought and sold wives, which was not true. But if you married a woman, you had to pay to her family a fine. And this fine was fixed in the compensation schedules. So I think that that's the first step. This is how the notion of measuring one's debts came about.
Could I just ask one point of clarification?
Yeah.
What you mean by the penal system then is penal very broadly. I mean,
yeah.
Marrying someone we wouldn't think of as a crime, but it was a penal system in the sense that it was a charge levied against someone who was marrying a daughter.
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, and this survives today. We still say that criminals are paying their debt to society when they're in jail. Okay, and this comes out of the early Western justice system, the notion that you've got to pay a debt when you commit some kind of infraction. Now, in difference from modern society, these payments were fines. They did not use imprisonment. And second, the payments were made to the victims. Okay, now I believe that the second stage in the development of money comes along when there's a centralization of the collection of fines. As tribal society transformed away from a communal mutual aid sort of society to one based on authority, perhaps a command society, perhaps an oligarchy, these Wehrgeld compensation schedules were transformed in two ways. First, the authority wanted to get a piece of the action, a piece of the fines that were being paid, and so at least a portion of the fines, rather than all of the fine going to the victim, a portion would go to the authority. And the second is there was an expansion of the kinds of crimes for which fines would be levied. For example, hunting in the king's forest, you would have to pay a fine for shooting a deer. So this original justice system kind of morphed into one that is closer to the one we have today, in which your fines are paid to the authority rather than to the victim. So I believe that that is the second stage, a centralization of the collection of fines. Now, these fines still were, in the beginning, paid in kind. That is, so many sheep for this infraction, so many cows for this infraction.
Okay, and at some point then, there started to be some kind of token that was the introduction of tokens, right?
Yes.
Okay.
We need the development of some universal measure of value, so that rather than having a particular kind of fine assessed for one infraction and another fine assessed for a different infraction, we need some universal measure of the fines. And so we need a universal unit of account to measure these things. Now, the notion of measurement is extremely difficult, more difficult than you might imagine, because we're very used to measuring the value of everything. We can put a dollar price on everything today. But if you think back before there was any universal measure, you know, say that the fine for an accidental murder was a cow and the bride price was a horse. You know, how can you compare these two? How can you compare a cow and a horse? How can you compare a murder and a wedding? Okay, obviously these things are incomparable in early society. So how can you get a universal measure? Well, we do have some hints. We know, for example, that all the early money units were derived from weight units. And a weight unit is a pretty obvious way to go about comparing incomparables. Okay, we could compare them on the basis of weight. Now, this might not be a very good way to compare a cow and a horse. Okay, but obviously, for some things, comparing on the basis of weight would make sense. We know that these weight units were derived from grains. Okay, so many grains of barley can give you a weight unit. And in fact, we know that all the early money units were derived from weight units based on numbers of grains. And today, still, some money units reflect their origins, the UK pound, the Italian lira. These were originally weight units. So what we can surmise is that the way that we came up with a universal measure of value was to use a weight unit and to derive a money unit from that, so that now the fees and fines are levied in the form of so many grains of wheat or barley. Okay? Gradually over time, these early fees and fines kind of morphed into a greater variety of payments, including what today we might call taxes, a variety of kinds of taxes. Now, once you've assessed these fees, fines, and taxes in this money unit, then we have to have the authority define how you go about paying your tax. If I say that you owe a 10 shekel tax, I have to tell you how you can possibly meet that tax. All that I have to do then is to tell you, well, a cow is worth this many shekels and a horse is worth that many shekels. Now, finally, we've got a way to compare the incomparables so that you can pay your tax by delivering a horse. You can pay your tax by delivering a cow, and I put a price on those things as the authority. So now you've finally got the money unit, and you've got prices. And note that these exist before there is any market. We don't need any market for this. And in fact, it's very hard to see how you could have markets before you have money and prices, a way to compare the value of things that are incomparable. In mathematics, we're always told that, you know, you can't add together apples and oranges. Well, you can't do that until you've got a price on those things. Then you can do it.
And the government is responsible for, effectively, the government is responsible for setting the price.
Yeah,
by saying how many of these things you have to pay your taxes.
That's right. I've been vague on what kind of government we're talking about. In the beginning, it was probably a simple oligarchy. But it doesn't really matter. Even if it were a perfectly democratic government, we can make the same argument that that government first comes up with a unit of value and then puts prices on things, and that tells you whether you are able to pay your tax.
Okay, I really want to spend a fair chunk of time talking about the implications of this view, but maybe just spend a couple of minutes talking about the introduction of coins as a particular form of money before we then move on to talk about the implications.
Okay. But what I'm presenting, I call the taxes drive money parable, and that is that once I put a head tax on you, if I'm the authority, then you have to ask me, what can I do to get that tax taken off my head? And I tell you, well, you've got to deliver 10 shekels to me. And you ask me, well, how can I deliver 10 shekels? Well, over time, the authorities realized that they could issue anything and say it's worth 10 shekels, and that is the thing that they can accept back in payment of the taxes. For example, if I issue a token that I say is worth 10 shekels, then you would like to get hold of that token in order to pay your tax. This means that the authority is able to buy whatever it wants by issuing a token. So if I say that your tax is 10 shekels and a horse is worth 10 shekels, then as the authority, I can always go out and buy horses by issuing tokens worth 10 shekels. So I've created a demand for these tokens by imposing the tax. And so I believe that this is the way that we get the money things that are being issued. We already have the money of account, but we have to explain the source of the things that have value as money. Now, I have to tell you that coins came many, many years after the development of money. We know that there were very complex markets, very complex financial instruments that existed for thousands of years before anyone had the bright idea of inventing coins. I won't go into the traditional story about the invention of coins, but we know that coins come much later. We also know that they were created and issued by government. In the 1950s, numismatics, which is the study of the history of money, came up with an interesting thesis, which is that coins were originally issued in order to pay soldiers and sailors, in order for the government to pay the soldiers and sailors. That is, they were an instrument of state finance from the very beginning. Now, throughout most of Western history, coins were issued in the form of precious metals. And the traditional story is that the value of these coins is determined by the quantity of precious metal embodied in the coin. In other words, if there's an ounce of gold in a coin, the value of that coin is determined by what an ounce of gold is worth. Now, there are reasons to doubt this. First, it seems to be the case that coins almost always circulated at a value above the quantity of embodied precious metal. Second, ancient coins never had any nominal value stamped on them. Okay? They seem to have been worth whatever the authorities said they were worth. Okay? And you have to ask, why would anyone accept a gold coin at a nominal value that is above the value of the gold embodied in the coin? And the answer is that as long as the authority says, I will accept that coin in payment of taxes at the value of one shekel per coin, that is the value that that coin is going to have. So it seems that coins were issued as part of state finance, finance of the government, in order to buy things. Why would the population accept them? Because the population had to pay taxes, and the state promised to accept them back. Now, on this view, it doesn't really matter what the token is made of. It could be made of gold, it could be made of clay, it could be made of wood, it could be made of pieces of paper. And it doesn't really matter much what it is made of. Okay, and so this is the alternative view that I am presenting. Now, I still have to explain why did they use precious metal for many hundreds of years before we transitioned to green pieces of paper as the primary currency issued by government. And I think that there are two possible answers here. One is a sort of a practical explanation, and that is that precious metal coins were a bit harder to counterfeit, because in order to counterfeit the coin, you had to get hold of the precious metal. And early governments almost always monopolized the mines for precious metal and also monopolized the mint. And I think that a good part of the explanation for that was in order to make it harder to get hold of the gold in order to counterfeit the coins. But the second reason probably is at least as important, and that is it could be something of a historical accident. That is that precious metals were already highly valued. They were used in complex spheres of gift exchange among the elite. Coins developed in Greece, and there's a recent very interesting book by a person named Leslie Kirk, which argues that it's the historical accident that coins were invented in Greece, in which precious metals already were at the very top of the hierarchy of gift exchange, and the creation of coins was an attempt by the city, the polis, in order to sort of thumb its nose at the oligarchy by coining precious metal.
Okay, we really only have about 3 minutes left. So what I'd like to do is to talk about the implications, and I think we're only going to be able to talk about one of them. Specifically, what I'd like you to do is to explain how your alternative view of money deals with the issue of government surpluses and deficits. I mean, what you've shown so far, what you've argued so far, is that any proper account of money has to give prominence to the government, and moreover, that money is non-neutral. It's not just tied to the issue of inflation. So in the remainder of the show, try to explain why or what the implications of your view are for issues of government deficit and government surpluses, which is a hot topic right now.
Okay, very quickly. Everyone knows, of course, that governments are very bad and surpluses are very good. Under Reagan and Bush, our government ran up huge deficits, spending several trillions more than its income. That is supposed to be a bad thing. Under Clinton, this has been turned around so that we're running surpluses now, and they are projected to run into the several trillions over the next decade. Everyone thinks this is great. But if you think about what does it mean? It means that the government today is spending less than it is taxing. It is issuing less money to the population in the form of, initially in the form of currency, than it is draining back out of the economy. In order to run a surplus, the government is reducing the non-government sector's net income. That is, it's injecting less income into the system than it is taking out in the form of taxes. It is also reducing the non-government sector's wealth, because the only way for us to pay more in taxes than we receive from the government is to turn over our currency to the government, to trade in our bank accounts and possibly our treasury securities to the treasury. Now, it's believed by traditional economics that this is a good thing, that it allows the government to save for the future. 30 years down the road, it'll make it easier to take care of the baby boomers, because the government is socking away all this money it's going to be able to use in the future. But according to the view that I've been presenting, this is all nonsense. When the government is running a surplus, what it's all it's doing is reducing our wealth, and the government can't sock this money away for the future. This money is the government's liability, and actually, as it flows into the government coffers, the government essentially burns it. When treasury securities are turned back, these are just numbers on balance sheets. They just disappear. When the green paper money flows into the government can choose to either stockpile it, but mainly it's just going to burn it, because it doesn't make sense to stockpile a lot of pieces of green paper. Since it's just the government's liability, it doesn't make any sense for the government to stockpile this for the future. Once you understand that the issue of currency is the way that the government finances its spending, you understand that the government does not need tax revenue in order to spend. The government doesn't need to borrow in order to spend more than it receives in the payment of taxes. And in fact, because the non-government sector wants government currency and wants to hold government securities, the normal situation to expect is one of a government deficit. Now, if you go back through U.S. history, there have only been six periods in which the U.S. government ran a substantial surplus. Every single one of these led immediately to a depression. The last one was the Great Depression of the 1930s. Surpluses drain income. They destroy non-government wealth. They always lead to a downturn of the economy, and this is why Clinton's projections of surpluses, as far as the eye can see, are going to prove to be wrong. The surpluses can't last, and they're very dangerous for the economy.
Okay, thank you very much for appearing in the show today.
Okay, thanks a lot.
I've been speaking to Randall Ray, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This is Hugh LaFollette, Fridays and Issues. Good day. Thank you.